We can probably agree that it takes a lot of work to raise a child. It can also take a lot of work just to bring that child into the family. That was the case for today's guest. Suzanne Antonetta and her husband met their baby boy at the airport in Seattle 17 years ago. He came from Korea after a lot of effort, a lot of thinking, a lot of decisions. Suzanne Antonetta details all of that in her memoir, Make Me a Mother. If you've heard the name before or haven't, Suzanne Antonetta is a poet and memoirist with two other memoirs to her credit, along with several books of poetry. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The New Republic, and Best American Essays, among other publications. Suzanne Antonetta, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
You dropped some really interesting facts about adoption in here, like the percentage of families that do adopt in America.
Yes. That percentage is about 4%, and that is legal adoption. If you put into that informal adoption, which is very common, particularly in Latino and African-American households, meaning, you know, the kid moves from one household to another, but you don't go to court over it, it would be a lot higher. It is a high number, but when you think about the number of people who are in what I consider an adoptive parenting situation, it would really be off the charts. And by that I mean they're step-parents, or they have a child through reproductive technology with donor eggs, donor sperm, maybe both. You can actually now give birth to an adopted child. It would be really very, very high. Most of us, I think most family households are in what I call an adoptive situation in some way.
And so by including step-parents, you certainly broaden the zone quite
mm-hmm.
a bit. Yeah. So what is the truth about infertile couples and their common choices in parenting? This is a really interesting thing you bring up in the book as well.
Yes. Well, one of the things that made me really want to write the book was the amount of misinformation out there. Most infertile couples do not adopt. They simply choose not to or choose not to have children because their parenting plan was based on having a child biologically. And that's honorable. You know, we all understand our limits, and that's a good thing. Many parents who adopt are adopting preferentially. I would certainly put myself in that category. Even as a child, I knew I wanted to adopt. So there are some infertile parents who adopt, but that's not the majority of us, especially if you look at adoption from foster care.
Why did you want to adopt, or even as a child, you say you knew this?
Well, Jeff, you know, it's hard to say sometimes why these things are just in your heart. I'm really not entirely sure. I think some of it was growing up in the 60s. You know, we were all very aware of overpopulation being an issue. We've kind of gotten away from that as a culture, but there was even a group called Zero Population Growth, and we were very concerned about just the number of folks on the planet, and that kind of put adoption into the cultural discussion. So that certainly was part of it. Part of it, I think, was just being one of a big family and realizing that you really can love almost any child that comes into your life, regardless of how they come into your life. So a bit of both of those things.
And there were some specific circumstances that led you and your husband to adopt.
Mm-hmm. We were a little concerned about our genetics. You know, we did both have bipolar disorder in the family. But so that weighed in a bit. But, you know, it's a lot of many different things. We were also just excited about being adoptive parents. I kind of thought we'd be biological parents and adoptive parents, but that's not how it worked out. So,
and that is a pretty common situation, it turns out. I mean, you mentioned all the different types mm-hmm. of things that you consider adoptive relationships, mm-hmm. but the fact is that it sounds like a lot of adoptions are adoptions by couples who have had their own biological children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we belong to a group of maybe 40 or 50 families who've adopted. It's a very informal group, and I'd say the majority do have both bio and adopted kids. And sometimes you'll see families where the bio kids, they've had them fairly young, they're ready to leave the nest, and they kind of feel like, we're not done. We want to keep going. The writer, Melissa Green, who chronicled her adoption in a wonderful book called No Biking in the House Without a Helmet, is that kind. She had four children and then adopted five.
Wow.
Yeah, sometimes you're just not ready to stop being a parent, but you kind of feel like, you know, it's maybe not the most responsible thing to keep just having them, or you're just ready to be a parent in a different way.
Suzanne, you point out in the book that your work has taken you in a lot of places around the world, and you are aware of adoption and how it is viewed in other cultures. Is the American way of looking at adoption very different from much of the world?
Well, our way of adoption is different because we are very, very genetically oriented at this point in our culture. I always say genes have kind of, or the story of genes has kind of taken over from the story of Freud. It used to be that if you were kind of a strange person, you know, we would all think in Freudian terms and blame your mom. Mom must have been a little kinky. But now we kind of think of everything in terms of genes. I mean, your waiter at a restaurant says, well, I have the chocolate gene. I recommend this dessert to you. Or you have the shopping gene, or, you know, we explain everything in terms of genetics, where most cultures understand genes very differently. Throughout all the Pacific Rim countries, children are considered yours because your work feeds them. The work of your body feeds them and causes them to grow, your land, your soil, your labor, whatever it is. So rather than seeing it as just this kind of static thing where you pass along genes, you're having a lifelong biological relationship, adopted kids or not.
Or not what? Where'd you go?
I'm right here.
Okay. Was there more to that sentence?
No.
Okay.
I'm trying to wrap up because I heard the music.
That's okay. We got a little time. Okay. We'll take it to the break right now. Suzanne Antoinette is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Make Me a Mother, her memoir about adopting a child from Korea with her husband. We'll come back and talk more with Suzanne. Take your phone calls and emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Suzanne Antoinette. She's now out with her third memoir, this one about the process of adopting a child with her husband Bruce from Korea and the whole process that that took. And there's a lot of backstory for Suzanne in her life and what led up to the adoption and a lot of stuff that's happened since that time as well. Make Me a Mother Again, the book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. The reason I asked the previous question, Suzanne, about other cultures and the way they view adoption, I can remember... It seems like when the boomers were kids, there's always that thing, and I'm not sure if it's just confined to that generation, but the kids thinking, oh my God, I was adopted. And there being a certain level of stigma involved with that. I mean, is that still something prevalent in our culture?
I think oddly enough it is. And I say oddly enough because, we all know people, or at least I do, and celebrities and other folks who have had children through surrogates, through, as I said before, sperm and egg donation. But somehow the actual adopted kid is still seen as somehow a little bit different. And one of my missions is to change that. You know, this is a family formation. It goes back to Hammurabi's code, the earliest legal code we've got. Several thousand years, B.C. has 9 laws governing adoption. It has always been done. It has always been a common way to form a family. And it is, you know, it's really no different than having any child that you raise that is not yours biologically, which, as I said, many of us do, even if it's just that neighbor kid who wanders in and you're sort of a surrogate parent. And interestingly enough, we're finding now that with the assisted reproductive technology, that those kids have the same feelings that adopted children do. They look for their bio parents. Even if the bio parent is from a sperm bank, many of them want to search. Many of them want to meet them. Many of them want to know more. So it's no different. It's kind of a continuum that I think we'd all have to agree is very much a part of our culture. We have very fluid families, and that's probably a good thing.
We should point out here, too, the fact that you're quoting the Code of Hammurabi isn't because somebody just happened to bring it up in a visit to Starbucks or something. You're a bit of a researchaholic, aren't you, Suzanne?
I'm a researchaholic, but the adoption research, once I started on it, I couldn't stop. And, I mean, I did quite a bit more than ended up in the book. But, yeah, the fascinating thing that I found, or the most fascinating, to just give one illustrative point, was that Romans, you know, ancient Romans practiced adoption very, very freely, and they actually had a lot of court cases over biological parents wanting adult children returned. So you can actually see these testimonies of adoptive parents, and there's one that's just so beautiful. It was a father saying, you know, in the court, when my son went to war, who hung on the walls of the city to see him come home, to see if he was injured? It was me. And this was an adoptive father pleading for his son to be left in his care. Because as I said, in Rome, your children were kind of yours for life, including their income. So there was a fair amount of litigation to get kids back after they'd been adopted out and raised by somebody else.
Including their income, though. That's interesting.
Yeah, they had a strange system of the pater familias, you know, the father being the absolute family head, and he was, in some senses, kind of in charge of everybody throughout their lives.
Wow, bit of a difference from today's world, certainly as we know it.
We can't, we can't control the, you know, the little buggers for the first 18 years of their lives, practically.
Right. So, is Gene 18 now?
He is 17 in 6 days. Actually.
Oh, really? Okay. And it is pronounced Gene, not Gin, right?
It's pronounced Gin in the U.S. Because Gene would, it's Jinu or Gene in Korean or China. In Asia, they would pronounce the I as a long E, but here we just pronounce it with the American.
All right. So he goes by Gin.
He goes by Gin, yeah.
So the night before Gin's arrival, how did you spend that evening?
We went to a restaurant and drank far too many martinis because we were just nervous wrecks. And, you know, they talk about the baby imprinting on your odor, and I have this horrible feeling that for his entire life he's going to associate mom with gin. And not his kind
not
of
his
gin.
Not his name, right.
The kind
yeah.
with a G. And we were just wrecks. And luckily these friends had come with us because we said, oh, no, we're going to be fine. They said, no, you're not going to be fine. So we stayed up all night, and then when we went to the airport in the morning to actually get him, SeaTac Airport, this cavernous, gray, poorly lit satellite, I ran through security, and I was covered with, you know, cameras and huge diaper bags. And so I'm sure I looked like, you know, 10 kinds of suspicious person. But the guards actually had to chase me down and stop me. And it was just nerves. I just wasn't even thinking.
I should point out this was 4 years before September 11th.
It was. But I think, you know, they as soon as our friends explained what was going on, they completely understood. And, you know, it probably wasn't as bad as it would have been if it happened after that.
Was the martini imbibing partly because you didn't have to worry about any effects on the baby biologically?
Yes. Yes. I thought, a friend of mine said, you know, the one good thing now is that you're not pushing something out of you and you can drink. And I thought, okay, I can get behind that. So I was, I was downing martinis. And, of course, it was the last time we drank alcohol for a good while because, you know, with a baby in the house, you just don't really do that.
Don't get that kind of time, certainly, with a baby.
No, and you don't want to be kind of spaced out right. Babies around.
So describe that moment, if you would, when the babies, and it was more than one, came out.
Yeah, it was wild. First of all, we went and looked at them through the window as they went through customs. And my husband, who was just as spaced out as me, was pointing to the baby in pink and saying, I bet that's Jin. And I said, honey, they put him in blue. He's a boy, right? So we were both just completely kind of unglued. We were excited. We were nervous. We couldn't imagine. You know, we drove down with an empty car seat, and we just kept looking at it, saying, oh, my goodness, there's going to be a baby in there, you know, tomorrow, in an hour, and, you know, whatever. And then when he came out, I knew him immediately, but I just froze. A friend of mine actually took me by the shoulders and shoved me. it was so emotional. I just froze completely.
Wow. Just stopped in your tracks, deer in the headlights.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm curious to know about, you know, when you talked about the car seat, it triggers the thinking about the ways that people prepare rooms in their houses mm-hmm. for nurseries and things like that and start, you know, hanging mobiles over cribs and putting big clowns or maybe something a little less scary on the walls of the intended room. How much of that did you guys do, nest building for the baby? And how much did contemporaries, friends who had had kids, help you out with that?
Oh, our friends helped us so much, and my wonderful in-laws helped too, and our neighbors, all of whom had had kids a little before us. We did have a wonderful nursery that we set up, and we set it up kind of early, and then Jin's arrival got delayed, so we would actually just kind of go sit in there and refold clothes for hours. It was kind of our way of nesting and connecting when he wasn't there yet. And I think our friends saved us both before and after, you know, 100,000 times. I remember calling friends to come over and look at diapers to see if it was normal. I mean, that is, it's a first kid thing. I mean, my friends who have had first bio kids have had the same experience of just, you know, that sort of panic terror, and you don't know what's going on and what's normal.
But they also have the hormones, too, to guide some of the things going on, which I'm assuming didn't happen to you, but you make some reference in the book to having some feelings anyway.
No, actually, I think women do the same hormonal stuff. I nobody ever tested my blood, so I can't tell you if it was the same degree, but I was incredibly pregnant, spacey, hormonal, crying at everything, exactly like my friends who went through pregnancies. And I think that while, you know, certainly there are certain hormones like oxytocin that are produced.
The bonding hormone?
The bonding hormone. But, you know, we kind of sort of say, okay, it's a bonding hormone, pregnant women produce it, it makes them cry and weep and get emotional. But you produce oxytocin in a lot of different areas of life. One thing I found through another area of research is that you actually even produce it when you're with your animals, if you really love your animals, and they produce it as well. You and your dog, if you're having a cuddle, are each releasing some oxytocin. So it doesn't require pregnancy, it just requires, you know, being in that bonding situation, your body will respond.
Oh, okay. We know more about oxytocin than we did before. Mm-hmm. Suzanne Antonetta is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the author of the memoir Make Me a Mother, about the process she and husband Bruce went through in adopting their son Jin from Korea now 17 years ago. Join us on the Exchange if you'd like to take part in our discussion about this particular case and about adoption more broadly. 800-838-3760 around the region. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Jeannie, you there?
The way you tell the story gives me pleasure. Having given up a child, to know that someone could be so happy and excited about getting my child. And to meet her 30 years later when she was 35, like she said, you knew what I looked like, but I don't remember you, so I didn't know who to look for at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
But
aww.
It's a funny joke, too, about parenting, having four stepchildren and two other children, six after. The thing, New Yorker had a cartoon strip where the kids are walking home from school, of course before email, with a note pinned to them, invite your parents to the PTA meeting tonight. And the little girl says, they mean my mom and her fiance? And the little boy goes, no, I think they mean my dad and his third wife. Thank
you. Yes, we do have fluid families, Jeannie. And, you know, I've been a very outspoken advocate for remembering what birth mothers have brought to this process. I actually wrote an open letter to Jin's birth mother for Parade magazine for the Mother's Day issue a few weeks ago. I think birth mothers have done, in many cases, the most courageous act of parenting that child's ever going to receive.
So Jin was aware of this book being written, right?
Oh, very aware, yeah.
And what did he ask about it?
Good question. He asked a lot of things. I read it to him in chunks. I mean, there are chunks that he saw, and I vetted everything with him that I thought could embarrass him. So it'd be kind of like, well, if I talk about that you did this in high school, your first year, is that okay? And he would say yes or no. I felt like I owed him that. But he hasn't read the whole thing. And I have a copy that I signed and put on top of our bookcase. And I said, here's your copy when you want it. And he kind of looks at it. And he did ask me to set aside a copy for him. But he hasn't read the whole thing yet. And I think that's fine. I think right now having his parents be human beings is kind of not what he needs. He's a teenager. He needs us just to be mom and dad and the whole thing to be uncomplicated.
Ah, 17-year-old in the house. I can fully relate.
Yes, absolutely. They don't want to see you as anything but, you know, kind of a food delivery system attached to a little bit of homework helper.
Yeah, my favorite is when you drop off one of their friends and the remaining two, including your kid, stays in the back seat. That's a good one.
Yes, it's a good one.
So what was so back 17 years now, what was the biggest adjustment in those first few days with Jin?
Well, he was on Korean time, which meant we were staying up all night and sleeping during the day because that's what his body was doing. And just figuring stuff out, we were sort of like the most hilarious, scatterbrained parents. I mean, everything that happened, we just couldn't decide if it was normal, and we would sort of panic. But it was also just exhilarating. I mean, you just fall in love at 100 miles a minute with this child, and just walking him around town and carrying him and holding him, it was incredibly magical. But, yeah, we were trying to figure out. I remember one issue we had was that he didn't feed properly for the first day. And I finally realized that in Korea he'd had these very fast flow nipples that they don't really use in the U.S. So he was used to not having to suck much for his food, so he was frustrated. So we actually had to put knitting needles through the ends of his bottle so he wouldn't just get frustrated and cry. So a lot of those kinds of things, you're just trying to figure out your baby. But you're also, you know, it is exhilarating. It doesn't feel like you need to sleep or it's a burden.
And how long before he got adjusted finally to the West Coast clock here in America?
No, it took him about 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow, that's a long time. But
yeah.
He's brand new then, you know?
Yes, yeah.
You did decide to keep Jin's birth name and expose him to his birth culture. Was there ever any discussion about that, or was it something that you and Bruce assumed would happen automatically?
No, we knew we would do that. And we've been very blessed. We have an amazing community that opened their arms to us in our town and invited us to join a Korean Baptist church, which we did for many years. And that was just amazing and also fascinating because the adults in that church didn't speak that much English and we don't speak much Korean. So we would spend 3 or 4 hours a week with a group, you know, who we really considered family, but we couldn't really speak to. It made me realize that we put too much weight sometimes on conversation. But that was very beautiful. And we spent a lot of time in Asia, Korea and China. So, it's very much part of his worldview.
At the same time, though, you made sure that he got lots of exposure to American culture. There's this great vignette where you actually take him to an exhibit of Robert Mapplethorpe photographs.
Well, he was 6 months old, and we didn't think he, you know, Robert Mapplethorpe does kinky sexual photos. We didn't think he would react to it, but he saw this silly photo of a nude woman, and she had this kind of strap-on thing, and he just started laughing his head off, and we beat it out of there. We were so embarrassed.
And how old was Jin at the time?
He was only 6 months old, but I went and I checked my bazillion baby books afterwards, and they said that at 6 months, babies do get a sense of incongruity. They notice when something doesn't fit. So this young woman with this big strap on didn't fit, and he thought it was funny.
Wow, that's incongruity detected at an early age.
Yes, well, he was a sharp little guy.
Smiles did come fast, though, it would seem. I mean, it sounds like Jin was a pretty smiley baby, and laughter, too.
He was a really smiley baby. He was a really placid, calm, happy, belly-laughing child. And then at 2, he really developed the toddler resistance, and it was kind of a big shock that all of a sudden his favorite word was no, and if we took things away from him, he might have a tantrum. It was another one of those shocks. My husband, who is hilarious in just sort of over-diagnosing things, the first time he had a tantrum, he said he thought it was an epileptic seizure.
Really?
And he came and got me and said, oh, yeah, Jin's having a seizure. I'm going to call an ambulance. And I looked at him and I said, no, he's not. He's having a tantrum. I mean, he was lying on the floor, pounding his hands and feet on the floor and crying. And that's what tantruming kids do. It's very funny.
You mentioned a moment, though, and maybe more than one, when Jin responded to your tears.
He did. Yeah, he was very empathetic. He would actually, even as a baby, reach up and kind of brush them away. And if he had, you know, if he had a little language, he'd say, "Okay, Mama," you know, in this really sweet way.
Much more to talk about with Suzanne Antonetta. Her book is Make Me a Mother, about the process of adopting her son Jin from Korea with her husband Bruce. It's been 17 years now, and a lot to talk about, a lot more left to talk about here with Suzanne. We'll come back and talk more about Make Me a Mother and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join our discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Suzanne and you in a minute 25. Segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is poet and memoirist Suzanne Antonetta. Her latest memoir is about the process of adopting her son from Korea with her husband Bruce 17 years ago and all that went into that decision and all that has happened since. The book is called Make Me a Mother. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange if you want to talk to Susan about her own case specifically or about adoption and the great deal of research she did into adoption around the world and through history to make up the book. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. You say in the book, this is a really interesting line, you can't separate your mother's instincts from your writer's instincts. What does that mean, Suzanne?
Well, I realized as I wrote the book that I really was writing this for Jin, but it made me very aware of how much everything I'd ever written since Jin came into my life was for him, was a way of explaining things to him, of speaking to him in the future when maybe I won't be around. And I heard this beautiful story about Georgia O'Keeffe, who painted this one mountain over and over and over again, this mountain called Pedernal near her home. And she said at the end of her life that God had made a deal with her that if she kept painting it, he would let her have it. And I kind of think of writing for Jin that way. I've made this kind of a deal with God. The more I write for him, the more God will bring us closer, maybe. That's a little woo-woo, perhaps, but that's how I feel.
You had mentioned some concerns from your own birth family about bipolar disorder, for example. I mean, you yourself have had to deal with this in your own life, haven't you?
I have. I have bipolar disorder, and that was a concern. It certainly hit many, many members of my mother's family. I also had a very, it's not exactly in the same category, but I had a really rocky adolescence. I mean, really tough. I was a high school dropout. I had a drug problem. I lived in a kind of a scrappy North Jersey town. And one of my feelings as a mom was, oh, my goodness, I have no idea how I'm going to deal with a teenager. I don't have a template for it.
Nobody in your family did it particularly successfully?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they just kind of, yeah, they kind of let me go and didn't put up much, you know, much of a struggle for me. I mean, my parents, for a variety of reasons, kind of just dropped out of being parents early on, and I think that was part of what had happened to me. And I think it's like my husband also. His parents were alcoholics. They died very young. His mom was in many ways a very loving mom, but I think we both felt like we went into this process of being parents without any set of how to do it. Do you know what I mean? We hadn't internalized this is what parents do at this juncture, because we'd both had a lot of chaos in our homes. So another part of the book is just that trying to figure out how to parent when you weren't parented.
Right. So you really have a void there. You know what you don't want to do, which is what your own upbringing was like.
But yeah.
None of a lot stayed in the positive then.
Yeah. And I mean, I was bringing a lot of baggage into this. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is having to go meet with the assistant principal over a, you know, a fairly small thing. But I was actually more scared than my son was. I mean, I never had good experiences with high school principals in my day. So Yeah, it was. It's remarkable, but it's so healing when you realize you can do this.
We haven't talked about the biology that led up to ultimately a decision to adopt. I mean, you were pregnant at one time.
And, I was.
And there's another classic, although icky, vignette here, the doctor who diagnosed a miscarriage. What was that all about?
Oh, yeah, it was in the Deep South, and he was just this very traditional old Southern guy, and he wouldn't talk to me. He kept telling everything to my husband and referring to me as she, and it was a horrible experience. We had not at that point gotten pregnant on purpose. It was actually not a great time, and I lost the pregnancy. So, I mean, I would have loved to have had it, as it turned out, but it wasn't something that we had planned. But yes, it was an icky experience.
Your own doctor talked about the natural grieving process after a miscarriage, mm-hmm. but what did you feel?
I didn't feel all that much, and I think that it had to do with the fact that we didn't plan it, that, you know, adoption was very much in my playbook already. But, yeah, she kept telling me I was grieving and I needed to go to support groups. And I know a lot of women who do grieve terribly, so I don't want to sound insensitive. And I can see why you would. It just wasn't my experience.
So by that point in your life, I mean, adoption was always there as an option, but how much had you researched it up to that point? I mean, how much did you know about the things that you had to decide about, where the child was going to come from, how old, et cetera?
Yeah, well, we had done a lot of research even at that point. And as I say in the book, we were sort of led by the hand to Jin because we didn't start out adopting from South Korea. We started out domestic foster care, and that didn't work. And then we went to China, and that didn't work. And then we went to Korea. And it was the one place I was a little terrified of because I didn't know the country. I didn't know the culture. Very familiar with China. So it felt like, oh, this is going to be just this crash course, and am I up for it? Am I really going to be able to make sure he's in touch with his culture? And actually, it was a beautiful gift. Now, I love the country. I love the people. I feel like, you know, on my father's side, my heritage is Italian, and I just feel like they're the Italians of Asia.
In what sense?
They're very high touch. You know, they're huggy and touchy, which is, you know, unlike the reserved Chinese and Japanese. And they love the table. They love food. They love to argue. It's really kind of amazing.
You felt right at home there, it sounds like.
I felt right at home, yeah.
Sort of New Jersey across the ocean.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
You describe, again, some of those early days when you're still getting used to the idea of having this other person in the house, a person for whom you are totally responsible. But one of the big ones, and I think a lot of parents can relate to this, is what you look for when you walk into a child's bedroom at night when they're asleep.
Well, you just make sure that they're breathing. You make sure there's nothing there that could obstruct their breathing. I mean, I think we were sort of so over the top. I can remember Googling top causes of death for children under six and reading like drowning and grapes and hot dogs were choking hazards. And so
you'd be a fun
just,
person to Google with, can't you?
I know. Google can be a curse.
Yeah.
So if there was a grape in the house, I'd be sort of looking at it like you are the enemy. And I think that's a lot of first kid nerves. I think, you know, parents who have a bunch as friends of mine said, they were doing that with the first one, and with the second one, they were trying not to step on them. So.
You mentioned the terrible twos. You mentioned also that they came on like clockwork, right at 2.5. Mm-hmm. Just developmentally, though, I mean, was Jin doing everything on the schedule that people expected of any baby?
He was. He was actually a bit ahead. And it was interesting because he arrived in Korea. He had a foster mom, and we went to Korea and we met his foster mom. She's a lovely, lovely human being. They swaddle babies a lot of the time, so he was a little behind. He hadn't rolled over and things like that. But we could sort of tell that once he was let loose, he was going to catch up really fast, and he did. He rolled over, crawled, and walked before 11 months. So. Yeah, he was actually very ahead on that.
It sounds like his mobility caught you a little bit by surprise.
It did. We were not at all prepared for it. I mean, he went from just being a baby you could put on an activity blanket and just keep your eye on to a baby who was into everything within a couple of months.
Did you go for the cabinet locks and the padding on the corners of the coffee table and all that stuff?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And we had to do it really much faster than we thought we would have to. He was really lively.
You talked in the book about being very open with Jin about where he came from very, very early on. He's known the story essentially his whole life, hasn't he?
Yes, he's known the story his whole life. Around 2 and 3, he would argue with me. In fact, he'd point to my stomach and say, no, that's where I came from, and I'd tell him again. And it didn't mean that much to him until his preteens, around 10, 11, he really wanted to meet his birth mother. That was the age where that really peaked. But it's interesting to see the world through his eyes, because I remember when he was 10 years old, he was asking me one night if he could meet his birth mother. And I was gently saying, Jin, I don't know where she lives. I don't know how to find her. We can try when you're a little older. And he said, how can you not know where my mom is? You're the mom. So, I mean, they have that kind of dual perception that, you know, there's this mom out there and she's real to them and they want to know more about her, but you're the mom who gets things done. You know, you're the mom on the ground.
Yeah, you're the mom manager for the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's an interesting, there's an emotional moment here for you, certainly, that you pass along to us, which is he actually refers to her a few times, more than a few times, it sounds like, as his birth mom, which sounds like it was a bit of a punch in the gut for you.
Oh, you mean when he said real mom?
Real mom.
He said real mom, and that was around that age, that 10 and 11. He doesn't do that, but yes, he did. He said, I want to meet my real mom. And it was a punch in the gut. It was very upsetting, but it led us to have some really great conversations about what it means to be a parent. And I think ultimately was useful. And I think fortunately for Jin, he has a lot of people in the community that are adopted kids. My sister-in-law's mother, who he knew, was actually left on the doorstep of her parents in a little basket during the Great Depression. I tell her story in my book. It's remarkable. My sister-in-law still has the basket and blanket that her mother arrived in.
Really?
They don't know. They have no idea who her birth mother was. So, I mean, these kinds of stories. And my husband's father was not well cared for, but he was not cared for by his mom. He was passed around in the family. So, I mean, I think when you say those words like real mother, it can lead to some really great conversations about what is real. What does it mean to be real? What does it mean to be a mother?
And so that was, you mentioned that was around when 10 years old, so
yes.
7 years since then, technology's come a long way and information. First of all, within Korea itself, I mean, is there any similarity to open adoption, closed adoption? I mean, what's the concept there versus what we know here?
I do know families who adopted from Korea through open adoptions. It's unusual because having a child out of marriage is pretty stigmatized over there still. And they have reduced the number of international adoptions, which is, I think, a shame because they've not succeeded in increasing domestic adoptions for a lot of reasons, mostly that they have a negative birth rate. They're just not having kids anyway.
Really? So the population is actually shrinking over time?
It's shrinking, yeah. Hmm. They have a negative birth rate of 1. So they live in very, very small places, and it's expensive to have a kid there. You actually pay for a lot of things, including high school. So there just has been no luck getting the domestic adoption to increase, and they're not allowing as many children out. So they're warehousing children over there, and it's very sad. I'm sad to say that's happening.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little surprised as I read through the book about the orphanages still existing, large ones in some cases, in parts of the world.
There are plenty of orphanages around the world, and we actually have orphanages in the U.S., but they're group homes for children in foster care who aren't getting adopted. I mean, we call them group homes, but they function exactly like orphanages. So one of our huge national failures is that we've got 250,000 kids in foster care. We, last year, 23,000 actually aged out, meaning they hit 18 and had to leave the system without ever finding homes. So one of the things I'm really trying to push in talking about this book is the need for that to change.
And what do you think some of the options would be then for improving that situation?
Well, I think we need to create a culture that's a little friendlier towards the idea of adoption and just raise awareness of the kids in foster care and how many of them are really, you know, wonderful kids who are, you know, would just bring joy to any home. I think also some states have better laws than others in terms of fairly quickly getting kids through the system if it's clear their biological parents are not going to be able to parent them or simply don't want to, which is often the case.
That's been quite a struggle in the country, though, and I'm just watching over the last nearly 30 years in Oregon, the way things have gone back and forth about the emphasis on keeping kids, taking kids away from their parents at the first sign of trouble versus now this new option in the state of Oregon about seeing if we can just give them the tools to make sure the kids can stay in the home.
Yes, I know. The pendulum has swung really far. In Washington, in my hometown of Bellingham, there was a case of a girl who was actually beaten to death in front of her younger sister. It was really horrible. And the younger sister was still not removed from the home. So that's a really far swing of the pendulum. And I've always been a strong advocate for birth mothers and birth parents. But there has to be some sanity there into just what is a safe environment for a child. Some states are doing much better than others. New York is doing well. Georgia is doing well. Within the context of the whole. But I think Oregon and Washington are probably falling pretty far behind in that.
Well, the book certainly gives us a lot to think about in the context of adoptions and foster parenting and so much more that involves parenting outside of what we consider quote-unquote traditional avenues. The book is called Make Me a Mother. Suzanne Antonetta wrote it. She's been our guest on The Exchange. Suzanne, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jeff.